From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, commanding the UN peacekeeping force in Sarajevo, we'll hear from Canadian retired Major General Lewis McKenzie, who led the UN Protection Force in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. McKenzie is the author of the memoir Peacekeeper, which was a bestseller in Canada. Also, commentator Gerald Early remembers his Father's Day last year, one that likely won't be repeated. And TV critic David Bianculli critiques Diane Sawyer's much-publicized interview last night with Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has completed his first meeting at the G7 summit in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He joined Japanese Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama for a discussion on the U.S. trade dispute with Japan over U.S. car imports and Japanese markets. Mr. Clinton says he and the Japanese premier had a frank and open exchange. They agree their negotiators should redouble their efforts to seek a solution to their differences when they meet next week in Geneva. But Mr. Clinton says he's determined to make good on his effort to open Japanese markets.
I have instructed our negotiators to pursue every possible avenue of resolution before the June 28th deadline, and I remain hopeful that an acceptable, meaningful agreement can be reached. But if a solution cannot be found by the deadline, I will impose sanctions, and the United States will also pursue a case before the World Trade Organization.
The sanctions include 100% tariffs on several Japanese luxury automobiles. The House of Representatives has approved a $267 billion defense bill. Lawmakers added $9.5 billion more than President Clinton asked, a start on more B-2 stealth bombers, and the speed-up of work to defend the United States from missile attacks. The vote was 300-126. It goes to the Senate, which has voted to stay within the president's $258 billion request. The House has also decided to, the Republican leaders have also decided to give President Clinton a conditional go-ahead for approving a UN resolution setting up a rapid reaction force in Bosnia. Senate Leader Bob Dole and House Speaker Newt Gingrich have sent a letter to the president saying nations contributing to peacekeepers in Bosnia to protect their troops should be respected. France's new president, Jacques Chirac, has told reporters at the UN he's confident that the United Nations will soon authorize a new rapid reaction force in Bosnia. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
After separate meetings with Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali and the President of the Security Council, Chirac told reporters he did not expect the United States to oppose authorization of a new UN Rapid Reaction Force in Bosnia. And he indicated that the Security Council could approve the more than 10,000 member force as early as this afternoon. The French president also expected that Bosnian Serbs would release all remaining UN hostages within 48 hours. The new force is estimated to cost at least $400 million for 6 months. The U.S. would be required to pay about 31%. On Wednesday, the newly elected Chirac met with President Bill Clinton and Republican leaders of Congress. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 6.5 points at 4,497. The Nasdaq has risen 6 points to 902. This is NPR. Officials of Shell Oil Company say they're talking to the British government about changing plans to sink an oil rig into the North Sea off the coast of Scotland. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Shell says sinking the oil platform into the sea is the best technical solution for disposal, but company representatives in Germany admit sales have been badly hurt by the publicity generated by the controversial action. Greenpeace activists recently revealed the platform contains radioactive and toxic wastes. This week, customers in Germany and the Netherlands started boycotting Shell gas stations. Both countries border the highly polluted North Sea, and there is concern the oil companies will try and sink more of the 400 oil rigs operating there. German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel warned against using the North Sea as a garbage dump, and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl says he will discuss disposal of North Sea oil platforms at the G7 meeting of industrial leaders in Halifax. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Greek officials have condemned some 500 buildings after a quake in the Gulf of Corinth this morning. The Public Works Ministry says the buildings are damaged or they collapsed after this morning's tremor. It measured 6.1 on the Richter scale. Greek authorities say at least 15 people are dead and 59 other people are hospitalized. Dozens of others received emergency treatment after the quake. They were released. Greek leaders are visiting the affected region. The government has officially declared what many people often suspect: child-resistant medicine bottles sometimes keep adults out, too. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has ordered child-resistant packages redesigned to make them easier for seniors and other adults to open. The action stems from concern that some seniors avoid the frustration of difficult-to-open bottles by leaving the caps off. This poses a risk to children. The change will likely lead to caps that rely less on strength and more on cognitive skills, like requiring light squeezing while the cap is being turned. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the war in Bosnia grinds on, the role of the UN becomes increasingly controversial. Retired Major General Lewis McKenzie was the chief of staff of the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. He commanded the UN troops that opened the Sarajevo airport for the delivery of humanitarian aid. His experience as a UN peacekeeper dates back to 1963, when he joined the UN's emergency force in the Middle East. He later served on UN peacekeeping missions in Cyprus, Vietnam, and Central America. McKenzie was a member of the Canadian military for 33 years. His recent memoir, Peacekeeper, was a bestseller in Canada. Bosnian troops have been massing north of Sarajevo in the biggest military buildup since the start of the war. Today they attacked Bosnian Serb forces in what may have been the start of a military effort to end the siege of Sarajevo.
Well, we've been saying, a number of us, for the last couple of years that the Bosnian government forces are certainly in a position to take the offensive. It's an infantry battle in Bosnia, not tank and artillery. And the Bosnian government outnumbers the Serbs significantly. And the arms embargo has been pretty well ineffective. While it's kept large artillery and tank pieces out of Bosnia, according to the Economist, there's been over $2 billion worth of arms gone into Bosnia over the last year and a bit. So with those additional small arms, heavy machine guns, anti-tank weapons, etc., certainly well organized and well led, the Bosnian army could go on to the offensive. And it appears that's what's going on right now, although I must admit I question the figures of concentrations north and south of Sarajevo. The figure of 30,000 has been mentioned. I think that works out to about a third of the Bosnian army. So I doubt if that's the case. However, the prospects for an offensive, I think, are extremely high.
If the Bosnian army tries to break the siege of Sarajevo, what would that mean for the UN peacekeeping troops there?
Well, for a whole bunch of reasons that we won't necessarily get into, the Security Council launched UNPROFOR onto an impossible mission in late 1993 when they established the safe haven concept and the guaranteed delivery of humanitarian aid. I know I sound like a broken record, but that's because it's been clearly proven and was predicted by any number of people that you cannot combine a humanitarian mission and an intervention mission. The two just don't go together. And as a result, if the UN now finds itself incapable of carrying on with the humanitarian mission because its restrictions on freedom of movement are such that it can't freely move about the country, and it is not strong enough, and it will not be strong enough unless there's an additional 100,000-plus soldiers added to it. So the addition of this, quote, rapid reaction force, unquote, won't make any difference whatsoever in its ability to impose solutions, then I'm afraid the answer to your question is that the mission is dead, and the humanitarian relief that has assisted well over 1.5 million persons in Bosnia over the last year and a half to 2 years in particular is also dead, because you can't go wandering around the countryside in and out of the faction areas when you're taking sides in the conflict and giving up your impartial role.
I guess a lot of Bosnians would... A lot of Sarajevans especially would probably rather take their chances with a military effort to end the siege than to continue with the UN peacekeeping.
A lot of people outside of Sarajevo, I mean, if you lived anywhere in Bosnia except Sarajevo, you'd probably be a little upset It's sort of like the states heaping all its attention on Los Angeles and New York, and everybody in Canada heaping their attention on Toronto. I mean, the other places say, hey, we exist too. Think of Zepa, Srebrenica, Tuzla, Gorazda, all those other enclave areas who don't have any media there, so they don't get a lot of attention. They don't pop up on CNN or cable news, any other cable news. So I would imagine that a significant number of the Bosnian population would like to see their forces have a go. Unfortunately, the Bosnian Serb normal reaction is, because they're outnumbered, is to use their heavy weapons on those very targets that I've just mentioned. So there has to be an understanding, I would imagine, that there will be an increase in the level of violence, and that the international community has certainly seen fit so far to avoid getting involved directly in the confrontation.
I believe that 11 of the 15 peacekeepers that are still being held hostage by the Bosnian Serbs are Canadian. What are your concerns about them now?
Well, actually, there are 11 Canadians that are still being held hostage, and I'm glad you use that term. Our government's trying to say they're detainees or guests or whatever. No, they're hostages. They can't leave, and they can't go back to their camps, so they're hostages. The other 15 are United Nations observers, unarmed observers, of which one, Captain Reckner, who was my assistant for a couple of years, in fact, is the lad that was chained to the pole out in Odin Palais. It doesn't surprise me that they're Canadians. We are probably the most outspoken critics of intervention behind the closed doors during this negotiation process, and therefore, by holding our personnel, you probably get more of diplomatic pressure, once again, behind closed doors, quiet diplomacy, they like to call it, from us than anybody else. And that's because we've been in this bloody peacekeeping game since 1956, when it was invented by a Canadian, and therefore we understand quite clearly that you cannot combine humanitarian and intervention missions.
Did you worry about a hostage crisis under your watch?
Worry about it? I had one. I was one. I mean,
you were a hostage?
Yeah, absolutely. This isn't something new. It started to get publicity because, you know, the American media started covering it. We went through hostage takings from May of 1992. I had 25 soldiers being held with guns to their head. I had a gun to my head and my seven or eight people that were with me. I was trapped in Lukovica for a significant period of time. This goes with the business, I'm afraid. And unfortunately, when you're stuck in the middle of warring belligerents, there's not a hell of a lot you can do other than diplomacy. We weren't fortunate enough, as you were, to have one of yours, bless him, shot down in the middle of nowhere where it was possible to send in an extraction group. You can't do that when you have about 500 people, if there were 500 people sitting around guarding him. I'm delighted you were able to get him out. But this is not something new, and quite frankly, without wanting to be terribly facetious, when our people are released from being hostages, they don't appear in Larry King Live. They go back to work, just like the last 280-some that have been released. They'll go back to work. When our 11 Canadians are released in Visoko, if in fact there isn't a massive attack by the Bosnian government there and an outbreak of fighting, they'll go back to work. I mean, this is part of the business. It goes with the turf.
When you were being held hostage with a gun to your head, did you think that this was a time to reason with the people who were holding the guns?
You're damn right. Nothing else came through my mind. I was surrounded by about 200,000 to 300,000 warring belligerents, and I had four French soldiers with me, two Canadians, and three Swedes. And my first interest was to get them back to their countries alive. So, yeah, negotiations seemed probably to be the only option at that particular time.
Well, how did you negotiate with a gun at your head?
Very quickly. Yeah, very quickly. Yeah, and very persuasively, too, because about 8 hours later, we were sitting back in our headquarters.
What did you say?
Well, actually, I used the media and did that quite a bit, and I was grateful for the presence of the media, because naturally, being the commander of the force in Sarajevo at the time, reminding the people that were holding me hostage that this would probably make the top story on CNN that night if the local UN commander was blown away, and might even upset the United States to such an extent that it might actually get involved in the conflict. So little things like that. And also talking about the presence of Yugoslavian citizens on the soccer teams in Toronto and cementing the relationship between our two countries, et cetera, et cetera. You try all the gambits. You work up and down the spectrum.
And why were you taken in the first place? What was the circumstance?
It's a miserable story. This particular event happened after President Ica Begovic had been kidnapped by the Bosnian Serbs and was being held against his will in a Serbian camp off the end of the runway. And through a period of negotiation, we brokered an exchange between him, his daughter, and his translator, and the headquarters of the Yugoslavian National Army, which at that time was still located in downtown Sarajevo. And both sides sort of swore to honor the deal. And halfway through the deal, as the Serbian convoy was leaving Sarajevo, it was ambushed by the Bosnian government. I had the commander of the Yugoslavian National Army and President Ica Begovic, if you can believe it, in the same vehicle in order to provide them both with some security. I, at no time, have ever blamed President Ica Begovic for breaking the deal, because I don't think he had any intention to not live up to his end of the deal, and he was as shocked when the convoy was attacked by his troops as I was. And after that particular attack was over and approximately 150 Bosnian Serb soldiers had been taken prisoner and a number of them had been executed on the spot, my standing with the Bosnian Serbs wasn't particularly high, as you can appreciate. Even though we had 16 people there, we were not guaranteeing the security of the convoy. It was the president of Bosnia-Herzegovina that was making that guarantee. And somebody within his presidency and or within his army saw fit to break that promise. So when we arrived at Lukovica with the remainder of the Bosnian Serb convoy, which is only about 50%, then naturally when we tried, first of all, they were good enough to let us leave, but when we attempted to leave, then we were taken prisoner at one of the checkpoints before we got back to our headquarters. And after 2 or 3 hours of bouncing around and being moved from pillar to post, ultimately we found people of reason who realized that it wasn't our fault that the convoy had been attacked, and they permitted us to return to our headquarters.
What a story.
Yeah, it was an interesting evening, particularly as for the first time in the entire mission, I decided to wear my, what your folks down there would call my dress uniform, my summer dress uniform. I just wanted to recognize the fact it was Sunday. And so I put on my tan uniform, and which is extremely thin, unfortunately. And it was one of the colder nights in Sarajevo. So as we were being held hostage, and I openly admit, scared, we probably looked even more scared than we were, because we were freezing to death. And all of us were vibrating, because naturally I had all my soldiers wearing the same uniform. So we were standing there shaking like mad, trying to explain to people that, yeah, we're scared, but we're not that scared.
My guest is retired Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie. He commanded the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with retired Major General Lewis McKenzie, former commander of the peacekeeping force in Sarajevo. You've made it clear that you think that a humanitarian mission and a mission of intervention do not work together, that the UN can't be doing both. What do you think the UN's mission should be in Sarajevo, in the former Yugoslavia? Let me broaden that.
Yeah, well, I'm very much on side with the Secretary General's report to the Security Council, which they have not seen fit to debate, at least in public, in the last 2 weeks. By that I mean, I really thought that he had backed them into a corner for one of the few times in the UN's history. He said, here are four options. Two of them were really throwaway options. One was to get out altogether. I don't think that's ethically or morally or practical. The other one was to carry on with the status quo. And the status quo is clearly unacceptable. So the other two were really the only two that they were going to consider. One was to reduce the scope of the mission, reduce the numbers, return to the impartial mission of negotiation, treating all sides equally with regard to their humanitarian needs, because all sides in the conflict have people who are isolated and need humanitarian help. The other one was to significantly reinforce the mission, to go into an intervention mode to force and impose solutions, but not to put it under a United Nations flag, not to wear blue berets, not to paint the vehicles white, and to put it under the leadership of a coalition partner, a la Korea, the Gulf, and Somalia, and all three of those were led by your own country, with participation with from anywhere from 20 to 40 other countries, but not to combine the two. Well, you know, they're not dumb in the Security Council. They realize that the Secretary General was after them to make the decision and to acknowledge that the two roles are not compatible. And unfortunately, if they try to continue combining the two, then I think it's serious enough that the Secretary General might even consider resigning. So to answer your question, I favor option number three, to return to humanitarian mission, to order, not invite, the belligerents into a padded room somewhere where they have to negotiate a settlement to this. Now, it's going to be a little difficult to find the room because you can't go to Geneva or London or Lisbon like they used to, or Helsinki, because General Mladic and Dr. Karadzic are both being investigated by another agency within the UN as potential war criminals. Well, that being the case, I don't think they're going to welcome an invitation to leave Bosnia and go somewhere else for a meeting, so it would have to be held in and around Sarajevo, and the airport has been the most frequently used place. That's certainly the one that I used in the early days of 92. So, humanitarian mission. If you are going to intervene, there has been no stomach shown by the international community to intervene with the numbers that would be required to impose a solution and stop the carnage. And as I've said many times, if you're going to do that, then you better start training your grandchildren as interventionists, because the mission is going to be there for many decades, because Bosnia is like phosphorus. When you put it in water, it goes out. When you pull it out, it'll blow up again. So when the UN force leaves, this whole thing will surface again and the fighting will continue. And I think that is tragic. And we can go back and agonize over what should have been done, but we have to deal with today and how we get to tomorrow. And quite frankly, I think they have to negotiate a settlement with the assistance of the international community, and the UN has to do what it does well, and that's ease the suffering of those innocent victims, of which, tragically, there are all too many.
Why do you believe a negotiated peace is possible after negotiations have broken down so many times?
Well, they've broken down for different reasons at various times. I mean, I brokered, you know, into the teens of ceasefires myself. And when they were broken because it was in the interest of one side to break the ceasefire, and there's nothing surprising about that. At the present time, we have a contact group plan that certainly doesn't recognize the reality on the ground, but could form the basis of a ceasefire and a constitutional solution. However, it hasn't been well endorsed. The Bosnian government admitted in public on television that the only reason that they were approving it last year was because they knew the Serbs would reject it. So that's not exactly a high level of endorsement. The Serbs said, no way, we've got 70% of the territory. Their claim is they started with about 60%, and therefore we're not going to negotiate back to 49%. And so both sides did not indicate that they were prepared to sit down and negotiate. Well, tough. We, the international community, have invested a lot of money and a lot of blood in assisting these people in solving their problem in a country that has relatively little impact on international peace and security. The time has come for the international community, and there are many ways to do it, to coerce the two sides into a conference room where, in fact, they're not let out for anything but sandwiches until they come up with a solution. And your country has played a major role, and I regret having to say this, having graduated from your war college, having lots of friends south of the border, and having great admiration for your country. But in this particular area of Bosnia, I mean, if there's a Guinness's Book of Records for political inconsistency, it should go to the United States on its Bosnian policy, because you have frequently held out the carrot, held out the hope that the 7th Cavalry was going to come over the hill and save the Bosnian government. And I think you've been very cruel to them in doing that, because they have continued with the hope that at some stage America will come and give them military assistance, not just delivering arms. And that has not happened. I'm glad it hasn't happened, because I think it would be a mistake in your foreign policy. However, nevertheless, your promise to them has led them to continue with this conflict and not to negotiate. And the Serbs very early on, learned that there was a lot of bluster and not a lot of substance, and they've been playing the international community like a well-tuned violin ever since. And once again, here I am going back and recounting history. What we have to talk, which was, by the way, what happened in every negotiation I got involved in, we normally started in the 14th century. With the Battle of Kosovo.
And right, Everybody airing their grievances from centuries ago.
I got to the point where I would walk out and leave and say, when you get to today and we can talk about what we're going to do tomorrow to ease the suffering, get some food here and there, then I'll come back into the meeting. And most people, unfortunately, go back and want to lay blame along the way. And depending where you start watching the movie, it's easy to blame just about anybody in Bosnia for what's happening. The trouble is the international community has to look to tomorrow and get these people together. And there's lots of ways to bring pressure. I mean, does the inverted commas Bosnian Serbian Republic want to be the, you know, the outcast, the leper of the international community forever? Does it want to be isolated? Does the new country of Bosnia, who just had its flag up in front of the UN for 24 hours before it was immersed in a violent civil war with overtones of aggression from both Serbia and Croatia, does it want to continue like that? No. They want to become legitimate members of the international community, and therefore there's lots of pressure that can be brought other than economic.
My guest is retired Major General Lewis McKenzie. He's former chief of staff of the UN Protection Force in Sarajevo. He is a Canadian, and he's written a memoir about his experiences as a peacekeeper called Peacekeeper. You started off in the peacekeeping business with the UN back in the 1960s. You have your serious reservations about how the UN mission was finally defined and how it's been working out. Give me an example of a mission you were on that you thought really succeeded in doing what the UN can do best.
Most of them, actually. There were 13 between 1956 and 1992, Sarajevo. Various degrees of success, because within the peacekeeping mandate there are so many things other than just lightly armed forces interposed between belligerents when they want to stop fighting. That was the idea that Lester Pearson, our subsequent prime minister, who received the Nobel Peace Prize for the concept, and that was established in 1956 when the Israelis, the French, and the British parachuted in and took back the Suez Canal from President Nasser, who had nationalized it. And it looked like there was going to be a massive superpower confrontation between you and the Soviets. And it was in Canada's interest to come up with some sort of solution. Why? Because if you and the Soviets ever went to war, you're going to fight it over Vancouver, Toronto, Halifax. That's where the missiles would have met. So, I mean, we aren't the Boy Scouts of the world. It was in self-interest, overwhelming self-interest, that we, the Canadian population, wanted to ease the tension between the two superpowers. So it worked in the Middle East. I was part of that force, UNEF-1, United Nations Emergency Force 1, on the international frontier and the armistice demarcation line between Egypt and Israel. And think of a hockey game. Players that get in a fight in a hockey game normally get in a fight fairly close to the referee. There's a reason for that. It's part of the game. It's the macho thing to do. But let's make sure there's somebody around to stop it before we both really get badly hurt. Well, countries are a little bit like that, too. You get tired very quickly in war these days between countries. And therefore, the UN provides that macho excuse to stop fighting.
Retired Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie. He commanded the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. Our interview was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more of that interview in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with retired Major General Lewis McKenzie, the former commander of the UN Protection Force in Sarajevo. Also, commentator Gerald Early on Father's Day and TV critic David Bianculli on last night's primetime live interview with Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives has voted to restore a ban on abortions at military hospitals overseas. President Clinton had lifted the ban when he first entered office. The vote was 230 to 196. Abortion foes, like Republican Robert Dornan of California, say these abortions are partly funded by taxpayer dollars.
This is a sad issue. It's a confusing issue. It's an issue where people put it on the line and then can't eat that vote or ever flip-flop back. And it's sad, and it strains friendships. It's too bad. It's going to be with us forever because it does involve more than taxpayers' dollars. It involves human souls.
The vote came on legislation, which is part of the Defense Authorization Bill. That has just passed the House of Representatives. The bill now goes to the Senate. A published report says federal agents are investigating an Arkansas robbery last year as a possible source of funding to pay for the Oklahoma City bombing. The Detroit Free Press says thousands of dollars worth of guns, cash, and other valuables were taken from a home. An affidavit quotes the robbery victim as saying bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh visited his home several times and thinks McVeigh may have been involved in the robbery. The affidavit says a safety deposit box key taken during the robbery was recovered at the home of the second suspect, Terry Nichols. Members of militia groups spoke at a Senate subcommittee hearing today. Senators heard some unusual theories of the way government works. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Everybody talks about the weather, but Robert Fletcher says the government is doing something about it. He told the hearings the government is using weather to starve and control Americans.
As bizarre as that sounds, when if somebody had told me that that equipment even existed 10 years ago, I would have thought they were nuts.
And he says he has documents to prove it.
And if you think that 85 tornadoes takes place in the middle of our growing area by simultaneous accident, I'm sorry.
Senators of both parties listened and indicated some skepticism about this and other theories of little-known conspiracies. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Lawmakers are considering violent movies and obscene computer transmissions as they rewrite the nation's telecommunications laws. The legislation is moving toward final passage in the Senate. Lawmakers have been adding rules that restrict children's access to indecent or pornographic material over the air, on cable, and through computers. The bill would ban indecent and obscene material on computer services and on the Internet. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has set a final vote for the bill today. It's been another record day on Wall Street. Stocks closed higher for a second day in a row. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 5 points to end at 4,496. Advances led decliners by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Four members of the Nation of Islam are jailed in Dallas. They're charged with kidnapping. They allegedly stripped and beat four black youths suspected of stealing from a shopping mall. Police say the men, part of a Muslim security detail, told the officers the boys admitted the theft. Officials say the boys were whipped with belts and bamboo canes over a four-hour period. No charges have been filed against the youths, but the mall's owner says if officials go after the security detail, he will press charges against the boys. Some independent scientists in France have attacked French President Jacques Chirac for claiming that French nuclear testing does not hurt the environment. They've asked to inspect the testing site. Chirac says France will conduct 8 tests. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
An independent scientific group which monitors radioactivity wrote to President Chirac demanding to inspect the French testing site. France has carried out tests in underground shafts more than 3,000 feet deep at 2 atolls in the South Pacific. The group of scientists said in a statement that the repeated explosions have created huge reservoirs of radioactive waste and fractures, which could allow the radioactivity to spread. Chirac said the tests posed no environmental threat. The state-owned Atomic Energy Commission says independent scientists visiting the site in the 1980s concluded the tests had left no significant amounts of irradiation. Chirac said the scientists were welcome to inspect the site again. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The leader of Chechen separatists says there's no link between his rebellion and a hostage incident taking place in a southern Russian city. Russian officials say a large group of gunmen are holding several hundred civilian hostages at a town hospital and demanding an end to the Russian military action in Chechnya. A senior Chechen aide has suggested an unorganized group of Chechen militants could possibly be responsible. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with retired Major General Lewis McKenzie. He commanded the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. He served with the Canadian military for 33 years. His memoir, Peacekeeper, was a bestseller in Canada. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Now, the impression I have is that there's a lot of people in Sarajevo who resent the presence of the UN peacekeepers because they feel that the peacekeepers basically stand by and watch.
You got it.
As people drop under sniper fire. What do you say about that?
Well, I think probably the dumbest mistake that we ever made, and I've got to accept some responsibility for this, is that when UNPROFOR came in to reinforce our modest little presence running the airport, we didn't change the name of the force. You recall I mentioned earlier that in Croatia, we were, in fact, UNPROFOR. We were protecting those people in the occupied territories of Croatia. Therefore, the title was correct. It was an unfortunate selection of a title, but it was grammatically correct. When it came into Sarajevo, it came to secure the airport. But if you'd been parked in Sarajevo for the last 3 months, April, May, June 92, shelled every day, not bombarded. I mean, Grozny is what bombardment looks like after 2 weeks. Sarajevo doesn't look like that after 3 years. It's been shelling. Very, very serious psychological impact when you have five or six rounds falling every hour in the city, sometimes more, sometimes less. And all of a sudden, coming into town is a force, minor force, less than 1,000, calling itself UNPROFOR. It wasn't unreasonable that you would think that that force was coming there to protect you, and therefore the war would stop when they arrived. You couldn't get out on every street corner and grab people by the scruff of the collar and say, this force is coming to run the airport, to bring food and medicine to you, because, quite frankly, people, that's what the Security Council has decided is the maximum it's prepared to do. Now, that wouldn't really fall on very friendly ears, and that's why I'm vilified to this very day by the people of Sarajevo, because we did not meet their expectations. We met what we were told to do by the Security Council, but that didn't match in any way the expectations of the people of Sarajevo, and I understand that, and now the entire people of Bosnia. You cannot get involved in regular acts of repelling, aggression, intervention, sniping, whatever, and it's coming from all sides, by the way. The French have had a number of people killed by the Bosnian forces. You can't get involved in that unless you have overwhelming force. Let me give you an example of overwhelming force. A lot of people laughed at the American Marines arriving on the beaches of Mogadishu because the press were there before they got there. That's exactly what you should do. That meant that America went onto the beaches of Mogadishu and stood offshore with enough force that nobody was going to screw around with them. That if the media could get there first, and bless him, Ambassador Oakley, representing your president, could get there and negotiate before the Marines arrived, that meant that the military was showing such overwhelming force that nobody was going to interfere. Well, that's what you got to do in Bosnia if you are going to go in and impose a solution, and the Security Council has decided that's not going to be done.
So with the peacekeepers in Sarajevo, their mission was to secure the airport, but you're saying the people of Sarajevo said, well, if you're the UN Protection Force, you should be protecting us.
Absolutely.
How did this affect the morale of the peacekeepers there? Did they feel torn about what they were supposed to be doing?
Yeah, but, I mean, when you talk peacekeepers, you're talking soldiers. If soldiers are well-led and they get satisfaction from what they're doing, then they're not going to sit around at night wondering what the Security Council's talking about. If they are, then they've got bad leadership. Leadership should isolate them from that. When you talk to a soldier from any of the 31 nations that were there during my command, they would tell you about the fact that that afternoon they'd gone into maybe the Muslim village of Butmir or Dobrinja or the Serbian village and seen people that hadn't had a decent meal. I mean, people weren't starving during the summer of 92. That was, I mean, eating grass was the big thing that was reported on CNN. It wasn't to the point that people were starving, but they weren't eating a very balanced meal, let me tell you that. And therefore, when you went in and delivered food, and more importantly, medicine, including oxygen and all the bits and pieces that hospitals needed, and you saw the reaction of the people that you were to which you were delivering this stuff, I mean, that is all a soldier needs to get satisfaction. It's like your people in Haiti getting the same satisfaction from getting rid of a military regime. So there was a lot of satisfaction. It's harder now. It's harder now because they're being interfered with by both sides. I mean, the Canadian battalion in Visoko now finds itself surrounded by the Bosnian army, and it's having 11 of its soldiers held hostage just down the road by the Bosnian Serbs. Now, obviously, the soldiers are saying, what the hell are we doing here? So this thing is beginning to grind a little bit, and as we are less and less appreciated, naturally, it has an impact on morale.
Do you feel like you were able to remain emotionally neutral, emotionally impartial, while your responsibility was to keep your troops impartial and neutral?
Yeah, I guess maybe 8 other peacekeeping missions taught me that. And there are very, very many people, particularly within the Bosnian side, that would agree that that wasn't the case. But I can, you know, I can shave every morning, look in the mirror, knowing fully well that it was relatively easy to remain impartial because each event could be justified probably in the minds of the people that initiated it. In other words, in similar circumstances, except for some of the most horrific, unforgiving, despicable acts that were conducted, you could understand why they did it. You didn't endorse it. You didn't condone it. You condemned it, but you understood why they were doing it because of their perception of what was happening. And therefore, remaining impartial was in fact possible and continues to be possible. And that's why it's so aggravating to some people that I can still look into the conflict and start with today to look forward to a solution. I mean, that's something I've been conditioned for in this peacekeeping game for most of my career. Although I've only spent 6.5 years out of 33 years and working with the UN on peacekeeping, and most of it, some of it was like a holiday. Other missions were more difficult. So it's a good question, and it's an answer that a lot of people won't accept, but it is possible to stay impartial amongst all that carnage.
My guest is retired Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie. He commanded the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with retired Major General Lewis McKenzie, former commander of the peacekeeping force in Sarajevo. President Clinton just said that the U.S. will pay for an expansion of the peacekeeping force in Bosnia only if Congress agrees. And
I love that system you have.
And there's a move afoot in Congress to cut back the U.S. commitment to peacekeeping forces. What are your concerns about what the U.S. will do?
I speak to a fair number of American audiences, and in my lead-up comments maybe shock them by saying, you're not cut out for peacekeeping. You're a superpower. Everybody wants you on their side, and therefore if you go into a conflict like Bosnia or any other conflict, everybody will be trying to kill you. All sides will be trying to kill you and make it look like the other side's doing it just to win your sympathy. And it's easy to do. It's really easy to do. In Somalia, if I had been Mati, one of the warlords in Mogadishu, I would have been killing as many Americans as possible and then blaming it on General Adid and then have you go after Adid and do my dirty work for me. So it's easy to get sucked into this thing. And having said that, it's got nothing to do, by the way, with the quality of your soldiers, which are absolutely outstanding. And for whom I have great admiration. However, If you don't make the UN efficient, and if you don't support the UN, and let the UN, with your leadership in the Security Council, enhance its capabilities so it can take on these tasks, you're going to do it, whether you like it or not, by default. And America will be the policeman of the world, and you won't be able to hide behind the moats of the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. You're going to be stuck into it. So therefore, I'm very concerned that this talk, particularly pre-election talk by one party in particular that talks about not entrusting U.S. soldiers to U.N. command. What a bunch of BS that is. None of us do. We all send our own officers with the U.N. to command our own soldiers. There's always a national chain of command. I mean, that's just a red herring. But if you stop supporting it financially without first arranging for some of the other folks who are sitting on their hands in the General Assembly to share the cost, and I would endorse that you should do that, I think there are many, many people that could pull more weight than they are. But if you don't impose your influence to get them to pick up the difference between what you're suggesting you're going to cut back to and what you are right now, say from 31 or 33 to 25%, then the thing's going to fall flat in its face. And it'll be partially your fault. And then all of a sudden, you want to think it's expensive now? You wait till the UN's not doing this work, and you're sitting there watching the world self-destruct as the last surviving superpower, and you're going to have to get involved whether you like it or not.
Are you glad that you are not commanding the peacekeeping forces in Sarajevo now? Are you glad you're retired and you're officially out of this thing?
No, not at all. I retired early because of all the controversy over Sarajevo, and I understand why. And I understand that the Bosnian government was not happy with me indicating that they bore some of the blame for perpetuating the conflict, not starting it. If anybody bears blame for starting it, it's the European community and its naive attitude that it could recognize independence before accommodation had been made for minorities, particularly in Croatia and in Bosnia. But you're asking a doctor if he enjoys the fact that he can't operate anymore, and I think he'd probably say, no, I don't enjoy that at all.
Well, General, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. All the best.
Retired Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie. He commanded the UN Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, in Sarajevo from 1992 to 93. Our interview was recorded earlier today. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Sarajevo?
Well, we'll be having a report today from NPR's Andy Bowers, who has spent several weeks in Sarajevo. His report on how the people of the Bosnian capital have been surviving through this summer, once again under siege. Also on today's program, we'll have news of the telecommunications bill that's been moving through the U.S. Senate, what's in it, and we'll be having a discussion on one of its provisions, the Exxon Amendment, which bans obscenity from the Internet. Also on today's program, we'll have a report on hearings that were held today in the Senate into private militias.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night on the ABC News magazine Primetime Live, Diane Sawyer devoted the entire hour to an interview with Michael Jackson and his wife, Lisa Marie Presley. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Oh, That's the new Michael Jackson single, Scream. On the CD and in the video, he teams up with his sister Janet to vent some frustration and attack his critics. I thought I'd play a little of it right away, because everything that happened last night stemmed from that song. Starting with the fact that if there hadn't been a new song and album to promote, Michael Jackson never would have done the interview in the first place. So now that I've started out by mentioning and playing part of the song, I've done just what Michael Jackson wanted me to do. I feel used. I feel cheap. And just imagine the morning after how Diane Sawyer must feel. If you don't think last night's Primetime Live interview was promotional more than anything else, consider this. Diane Sawyer made a big deal out of the fact that there were no restrictions on her questions. But if getting answers to those questions was the main point last night, why was Jackson's new Scream video run at full length, eating up about 10% of the available program time? And, as it turned out, there were some restrictions on her questions. Diane Sawyer put them there herself, out of sheer embarrassment.
You said you don't sleep in separate bedrooms, and I'm going to confess, okay, this is live TV, and I'm copping out right here because I didn't spend my life as a serious journalist to ask these kinds of questions. But I'm not oblivious to the fact that your fans had one question they most wanted to ask of you.
Do we have sex?
We have, you.
She didn't ask.
Okay.
You don't know what it was going to be.
Is that what you were going to ask?
Let's play just a minute or
Sorry.
Two. Let's play one or two.
We want to know if you've done the thing.
Michael, I know that this is an intimate question, but are you having sex together with Lisa Marie?
Do you guys really love each other?
One thing that Diane Sawyer has to realize is that it doesn't make any difference whether she asks the questions directly, or distances herself from them by getting viewers to ask them for her, or saying that out there in the country, people want to know. Diane, when you use your celebrity status to land an interview with another celebrity, and the topic list involves sleeping with young boys and whether a marriage has been consummated, then yes, Diane, apparently you did spend your life as a serious journalist to ask these sorts of questions. And it will get you taken less seriously as a result. Just ask Connie Chung, if you can find her. The point is, TV news magazines are so competitive these days that everybody chases after the same big interviews, even if they don't do much, if anything, once they catch them. They're like dogs chasing a car. When it stops, the fun's over, and they're never quite sure what to do next. The biggest thing we learned last night had to be inferred. Michael Jackson said that he settled out of court on the alleged child abuse claim because his lawyer said the case could tie him up for as long as 7 years. At another point, Diane Sawyer said that the money generated worldwide by Michael's latest record and video could approach $1 billion. Spread that sort of earning power over 7 years, and it's easy to see the settlement in purely business terms, as a short-term financial loss offset by much larger long-term gains. With Diane Sawyer, it's just the opposite. Last night's interview for her was a short-term ratings gain that's likely to contribute to a long-term credibility loss.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Last Father's Day, our commentator Gerald Early had just published a memoir about being an African-American father raising his two daughters in a predominantly white suburb. He tried to turn Father's Day at his house into a lesson for his daughters.
My daughters do not like to talk about race. They think it is a boring and belabored subject. Maybe this is the price of integration and living in a white suburb. It is more likely the price paid when a national political problem becomes, in various ways, both a personal and inescapable fixation. Race can be a tiresome subject, so it should come as no surprise that my daughters and some others of their generation have decided not to become exhausted by an exhausted topic. My daughters, naturally enough, do not like films about race. Don't get me wrong. They like many black actors. Denzel Washington and Samuel L. Jackson are among their screen favorites. They just do not like black actors who are playing specifically racial roles. If I suggest a film with a race theme, they turn up their noses with disdain. I bait them sometimes just to watch them flare up with indignation. Last Father's Day, in a startling act of generosity, after taking me to dinner, my daughters told me to select any video I wanted to have the family watch. Their choices usually dominate the VCR, so I did not take this gesture lightly. I chose No Way Out, made in 1950, featuring Sidney Poitier in his first film role. Poitier, playing an intern assigned to work at a white county hospital, is accused of criminal incompetence when the brother of a racist small-time hoodlum dies under his care. "Is this a race film, Daddy?" my 14-year-old daughter asks skeptically when I explain the plot. She fears that when race is the subject, a big sermon or lecture is about to hit her between the eyes. "You agreed to watch whatever I chose," I reminded her. My daughters actually like Sidney Poitier in Lilies of the Field and Blackboard Jungle, but neither film's plot was constructed upon the issue of race. Contrary to my usual custom, I told my daughters nothing more about No Way Out. I did not mention the controversy surrounding the film's release. It could not be shown anywhere in the South because of a race riot scene where the blacks win. Chicago theaters at first refused to show the film and relented only under pressure. Black people at the time thought it was the most honest and most hard-hitting film about race ever made by Hollywood. I offered no interpretation of the film and said nothing about either producer Daryl Zanuck, director Joseph Mankiewicz, Poitier, or the other leads, Richard Widmark, Linda Darnell, or Stephen McNally. We simply watched the film. When the film ended, my oldest daughter asked me why I had selected it. "It is the earliest film I can remember from my childhood," I said, "where I saw a black character on the screen who wasn't supposed to be funny. I remember when my mother took me to see the film several years after it was made that I was deeply struck by that." I thought they probably hated the movie, but my 12-year-old daughter liked it. "I thought it was a pretty cool movie about affirmative action, about how tough it is making it in a white world," she said. "I figured you liked the film because you saw yourself as a Sidney Poitier character with no way out." Her older sister disliked it. "It was the racist guy played by Richard Widmark who didn't have any way out," she said. "He was a loser who couldn't escape being a loser. Nobody figures that a white guy should get pity for being a loser. I don't like films that make me dislike white people for being racist." I learned a lot from what my daughters told me, but this Father's Day, we all decided no more films. They planned to buy me a shirt and tie instead.
Gerald Early is the author of The Culture of Bruising, Essays on Prize-Fighting Literature and Modern American Culture. We'll hear more reflections on fatherhood on tomorrow's Father's Day archive edition of Fresh Air. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrer, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.